What are the top 5 things you can do for a healthy long life? What is my current training routine like? And what are the macronutrients that I consume? This and a lot more in today's Q&A episode. If you want to ask me a question, then make sure you follow me on Instagram where I do those Q&As there regularly.
It's showtime!
Alright, the first question is top 5 things to do for long healthy life. Now, I do believe that it mostly comes down to the fundamentals. Like, there is very little evidence that any of these super fancy things like fancy supplements or fancy exercise routines or fancy diets have any, you know, significant effects on lifespan and longevity. It mostly comes down to nailing down the fundamentals and making sure that you don't, like, get a particular chronic disease early in life. Because the biggest thing that determines your, you know, maximum lifespan pretty much comes down to when are you getting these chronic diseases that most people die to. Like, if you look at the top killers worldwide, then they're heart disease, stroke, and neurodegeneration, cancer, diabetes, and those kind of things in developed countries. In developing countries, there are obviously like these infectious diseases as well. But in developed countries, the Western world generally, it comes down to non-communicable diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and neurodegeneration. And when you look at the average age of heart disease, then it's pretty much around 65 years. The average age of a heart attack is 65. The average diagnosis of cancer is also around 65 to 70. And the average diagnosis of neurodegeneration and dementia is around 80 years of age. So most people, the reason why heart disease is the number one killer is because most people die to heart disease around their 60s and 70s. And that is kind of the biggest bottleneck in terms of determining your maximum lifespan. Like, if you get heart disease in your 60s, then it's very unlikely that you will live to 100 years old, for example. Whereas if you get, you know, heart disease maybe a few decades later, like in your 80s or 90s, then the chance of you getting to 100 is still quite high. And this is what also you find in the centenarians. The centenarians are divided into like 3 main groups. There are these survivors. These people get a particular chronic disease, whether that be cancer, heart disease, or neurodegeneration, before the age of 80 and still make it to the age of 100. Then there's delayers. Those people are the ones that don't get a chronic disease up until the age of 80 years old. So they make it to 80, and then after that, they get a chronic disease, and then they still make it to 100. And then there's escapers. These are the ones that don't get any of these chronic diseases up until the age of 100. So these are the kind of pure, you know, most genetically best blessed or with the most healthiest lifestyle that avoid all these chronic diseases up until the age of 100. So the biggest rate limiting step to how long you're going to live is heart disease primarily. Like, most people will die to heart disease. Like, 1 out of 3 or 4 people will die to heart disease. And this is the biggest like bottleneck in your maximum lifespan. So for optimally living longer and healthier, it comes down to making sure that you don't get these chronic diseases. And this is a topic of my next book as well, which is called The Longevity Leap. And the idea behind that is that in order to live longer, you need to shorten the gap between health span or health adjusted life expectancy, which means the age or the duration of a life living disease free, and your maximum lifespan. And in so doing, you would also be able to see an addition of a few extra years to your lifespan by doing that. So making sure that you avoid the chronic diseases comes down to prevention, preventing yourself from getting the chronic diseases. That is what is pretty much the most powerful way to ensure that you live longer. And obviously it's also the most powerful way to ensure that you live longer disease-free, which improves the quality of those life or of those years. So The Longevity Leap is going to just talk about, yeah, how do you bridge the gap between your health span and lifespan, and how do you delay and postpone these chronic diseases with the proper lifestyle like habits and those kind of things. But, you know, chronic diseases, heart disease, neurodegeneration, cancer, diabetes, they are, you know, lifestyle diseases. Obviously there's genetics that contributes to that, but it's lifestyle and a lot of, you know, dietary practices, metabolic health, your fitness, all those things contribute to that. So taking a step back, what are the, like, the top 5 things that you can do to live a healthy long life? It comes down to, yeah, disease prevention and delaying those diseases. So what I would put the top 5 things into this list would be making sure that you're not overweight is probably like one of the top ones. because obesity, being overweight, it increases the risk of all the chronic diseases. Like, it increases the risk of diabetes, neurodegeneration, cancer, and heart disease quite a lot. And an obese person is expected to live around 5 to 20 years shorter because of the accumulation of these comorbidities and the development of these chronic diseases. Most people might not die to obesity per se, but they die to heart disease. But they get heart disease because of being obese, for example. So making sure that you're not overweight and obese is quite crucial, in my opinion, maintaining like an optimal BMI and optimal body fat percentage. You don't want to be overweight. You don't want to be obese. You don't want to have this excess amount of visceral fat as well. So even if your BMI is normal, but you have a very high waist circumference, then you're still metabolically sick because of the high amounts of visceral fat. And the visceral fat is actually one of more relevant in terms of metabolic syndrome and poor metabolic health than actual BMI or actual like body fat percentage. So, you know, waist circumference, body fat percentage, and making sure that you're not overweight and obese is number one I would put for sure. Then the second thing would be maintaining like a physically active lifestyle. Exercise is the most powerful, you know, activity for even like protecting against obesity. Like if you are physically very active, then your like risk of developing obesity and becoming overweight is also much lower. And exercise itself also has many additional longevity promoting effects. Like exercise pretty much targets everything that you need for longevity. Like it protects against heart disease, it protects against neurodegeneration, protects against diabetes, protects against obesity, protects against cancer, and it also slows down the speed of biological aging. So it maintains your biological youth for longer by activating these different longevity pathways and obviously maintaining a physical, let's say, body that is also younger and healthier for longer. If you have higher muscle strength, higher VO2 max, higher flexibility, all those things, then they are indicative of biological youth, if that makes sense. So you age slower and you maintain the physical function of someone who is decades younger by staying more physically active for longer and maintaining like a higher level of fitness. The third thing is to eat like a balanced diet. I don't believe that there is any, let's say, more of these like on the spectrum diets or whichever direction the spectrum goes, like either a plant-based super heavy vegan diet or a carnivore diet, animal-based diet. I think both of these spectrums miss the mark of what it means for longevity. For longevity, you don't want to be eating obviously too many carbohydrates, but you don't want to be eating too many fats either. So it comes down to like a balanced macronutrient split. That's what I've come to the conclusion of after years of research and years of, you know, trying out different diets myself as well. I think like a macro split, which I'm following right now as well, of something around like 25% protein, 40% carbs, and 30% fat is probably like the most optimal macronutrient split. Like a Mediterranean diet is obviously the most evidence-based diet for heart disease and brain health. And I think that, you know, something very similar to that is also probably the best for longevity. And, you know, eating a wide variety of plants and animal foods and dairy products and some grain, whole grains as well, is probably the most kind of optimal way of eating. But the most significant, you know, the overarching principle of diet is the calorie intake. Because it doesn't matter what kind of diet you follow, if you're overeating calories and you start to gain weight, you start to accumulate fat and visceral fat especially, then it doesn't matter what kind of diet it is, it's still bad for your longevity. So any diet can work to a certain extent, granted that it maintains a normal calorie intake and granted that it keeps you at a normal body composition as well. You don't want to become overweight, and any diet that makes you become overweight and obese is harmful, even if it's a healthy food diet. So calorie intake is king when it comes to diet, and then kind of opting for more like a balanced macronutrient split is what I do right now, and I think generally is, you know, most, at least based on the evidence, gonna give the most benefits for longevity as well. Number four is a very important point as well, because this is what most people, you know, give themselves heart disease with, which is smoking. So smoking is very bad for, you know, pretty much all chronic diseases. It's the biggest thing that contributes to heart disease and even cancer and neurodegeneration as well. So smoking is definitely like a zero tolerance policy. There's no healthy amount of smoking. Like any amount of smoking is actually very harmful for you. And in one particular study, they found that smoking one cigarette per day puts you at 50% of the risk of heart disease as smoking 20 cigarettes per day. So even just smoking one single cigarette per day puts you at 50% of the risk as smoking 20 cigarettes per day would. So you can imagine that, you know, any amount of smoking is bad, and even a single cigarette puts you at a significantly increased risk of heart disease, and it's almost as bad as smoking 20 cigarettes a day. Obviously, there's a huge difference between 1 and 20 cigarettes per day in terms of how much you need to smoke, but in terms of the risk, it's only 50% the same, and there's literally like no benefits to smoking, especially the most conventional cigarettes that you see. So I have a zero tolerance for smoking, and alcohol consumption as well. You know, there's a lot of controversy about, is moderate alcohol consumption healthy? Can you get away with 1 to 2 drinks or something like that? You know, it's confounded by some of the epidemiology studies that find that the individuals who don't drink alcohol at all, they're at a higher risk than those who drink moderately alcohol. I'll tell you right now that, you know, those studies are, first of all, epidemiology studies. They obviously don't take into account the healthy user bias. And there's also the problem that people who can't drink at all, they might have some other health conditions that prevents them from drinking. So they're already at a higher risk of mortality. So alcohol is also something that has no health benefits. You know, I think if you do drink, you could get away with maybe 1 to 2 drinks per week. If you drink like 3 nights per night, then that's already too much. I think like, you know, 2 drinks per night is also too much. But if you drink like one drink, let's say on Monday, the second drink on Friday or something like that, then you can probably, you know, you can get away with it. It's not going to have any adverse effects. But generally, alcohol is also something that in my book, in my, you know, worldview and philosophy, is also zero tolerance, that it has no health benefits and it only increases the risk of, you know, whatever kind of a disease it is, especially fatty liver disease. So yeah, alcohol and smoking, you want to avoid those things as much as possible. And, you know, ideally never do it for the rest of life, at least what I think. And lastly, the last point is stress management, because chronic stress is something that does age you quite a lot. We're not talking about, you know, shortening your lifespan immediately, but stress just accelerates biological aging. So you start to gather, or you know, you start to accumulate the age-related comorbidities much faster. Like if you're stressed out all the time, then your blood pressure is probably higher, your blood sugar levels are probably higher. And over the course of decades, it's not, you know, the chronic stress isn't going to kill you in months or years. It takes decades of being chronically stressed out to accumulate the stress-related comorbidities like hypertension and diabetes and kidney disease and those kind of things. So managing stress is quite important from the perspective of biological aging, that you want to make sure that you're not stressed out. And there's many things you can do to that, you know, to manage your stress. You know, spending time in nature, taking the sauna, you know, having a dog, playing with your dog or something like that. All those things can help to lower your stress. But the biggest thing is probably, yeah, just avoiding the unnecessary stressors in your life. There's many necessary stressors in our life. You know, most people have to work, they have to earn a living, they have children. Those are kind of necessary stressors. Like you can't, you know, eliminate your work, you can't eliminate your family or something like that. What you can do is still manage the other unnecessary stressors, like your environmental stressors, your, you know, exercise related stressors as well. Like don't overtrain if you're already stressed out because of work. So manage your exercise in a way that prevents overtraining, and make sure you fill your bucket, or like empty your stress bucket with downtime. Like, you know, spend time doing things that you enjoy. Don't always just, you know, go in this mode. Take time to spend in nature. There's a lot of research showing that nature bathing, spending time in nature, is very beneficial for lowering stress and strengthening the immune system. And just, you know, the light exposure, the grounding, the clean air, all those things are good for your longevity as well. So nature bathing is pretty underrated, but it's very powerful for stress management and longevity as well. And lastly, like some of the more positive hormetic stressors, like the sauna, maybe a little bit of cold exposure as well, can train your nervous system to be more resilient against stress. If you overdo it, if you overdo the ice baths every day for, you know, months upon end, every day ice bath, every day sauna, then yeah, you might become stressed out. But in moderation, they can actually obviously increase your HRV, which increases your resilience against stress. but also boost parasympathetic activity, which is the kind of relaxed rest and digest state of your nervous system, as opposed to being in this sympathetic state, which is the stressed out state.
This episode is brought to you by Alitura Naturals. Alitura brings you the best natural skincare products for radiating skin and anti-aging. Regular skincare products are full of ingredients and fillers that actually cause more harm than good. Alitura uses only active ingredients sourced and handcrafted in Hawaii. Their products contain zero fillers. The Alitura Night Cream received the 2021 Clean Cert Beauty Awards for Best Face Cream. Alitura also has skin moisturizers, clay mask, serums, and cleansers. Head over to alitura.com and use the code SIIM, S-I-I-M, for a 20% discount.
The next question is best protein and most absorbable. Well, if you look at the actual just biochemistry, then the most bioavailable and the most absorbable protein is probably whey protein. Like, it always tops the charts in terms of bioavailability and the protein synthesis response. It tops egg protein, it tops plant-based proteins, tops beef protein, etc. Whey protein is the most anabolic kind of a protein there is. Now, does it really matter? Like, protein bioavailability and protein absorption, or the speed of absorption, it only matters in a certain situation. Like, it only matters if you're eating a low protein diet, or if you're like malnourished, or if you're a professional athlete who just really needs to get highly bioavailable and highly absorbable protein very fast to recover from their workout or to prepare for the next workout. If you're a regular person who eats adequate amounts of protein, then it doesn't really matter how bioavailable the protein is. If you're getting sufficient amounts of protein, so if you're getting at least 100 grams of protein per day, 110, 20, even 150 grams of protein per day, then it doesn't matter what's the bioavailability, because you're getting such a large amount of protein that your body will just get all the amino acids that it needs to cover protein synthesis and to maintain muscle tissue and to, build muscle tissue as well at that point. So the larger your protein intake is per day, then the less important the quality of the protein is. If you're eating a protein-restricted diet, like you're eating only 70 grams of protein, 60 grams, 50 grams, then the more important the quality becomes, because you're already at a smaller intake of protein. And it has been found that at adequate doses, it doesn't even matter what type of protein it is, whether that is whey protein or plant-based protein or beef protein or casein protein, whatever it is, you might just need more if it's lower quality. So for example, 30 grams of whey protein to get the equivalent response for protein synthesis from a plant-based protein, you might need 40 or 45 grams of plant-based protein. So you need less protein in total, the higher the quality is. So if you're eating an animal-based diet, then you actually need less protein because the protein is higher quality. Whereas if you're eating more plant-based proteins, then you need a little bit more protein to make up for the quality, if that makes sense. But at sufficient amounts, the protein synthesis is the same and the final outcome is also the same, if that makes sense. If you're eating, let's say, 110 grams of protein from animal-based sources, then that's the equivalent of maybe eating 150 or 160 grams of protein from plant-based sources. And vice versa, if you're eating, 150 grams of animal-based protein, then 110 grams of plant-based protein is worse. obviously because it's less protein, but it's the quality matters at that point as well. But if you're eating 110 grams of animal-based protein, then that's pretty much covers all the demands for maintaining muscle tissue and to get the same response from plant-based proteins or something that is less bioavailable, even like beef protein powder, for example, compared to whey protein, then you would need a larger dose, so 150 grams. Next question, do you have a training plan or split, or you just do random stuff and listen to your body? Well, I definitely don't do random stuff. I have a plan that I follow. It's not specifically in my notebook that, okay, this is exactly how many reps and sets I need to do, etc. What I follow is a push-pull-leg split. So 3 days of the week, I work out with resistance training and I cycle between push muscles, which are chest press, shoulder press, maybe triceps, things like that. Pull muscles, which are pull-ups, deadlifts, rows, and leg muscles, squats, lunges, Bulgarian split squats, even Romanian deadlifts and those kind of things. So I just cycle between these three main muscle groups. And you don't really need more than three workouts per week. You know, working out more than that is actually counterproductive, in my opinion. It's certainly counterproductive for longevity purposes, and it might be counterproductive for even muscle building purposes, unless you are, you know, taking anabolic steroids or something. If you're a natural athlete, then working out more than four times a week is probably overdoing it. And you would be getting more benefits from incorporating more cardio at that point. Once you get three workouts of resistance training per week, then you don't need more than that, and you would be better off adding some cardio, in my opinion, for longevity purposes at least. For muscle building purposes, it might be a bit different. But yeah, I follow a push-pull-leg split, and sometimes I'll do, you know, barbells, sometimes I'll do calisthenics, sometimes I'll do dumbbells or kettlebells, so it just depends on the situation. But what I do still follow is the cycling between push muscles, pull muscles, and leg muscles. What I actually do is probably push muscles, leg muscles, pull muscles, maybe leg muscles again, and I try to cycle between upper body and lower body, so I never do like two upper body days in a row because it's kind of overkill in my opinion. So I'll do either upper body, lower body, or something like, you know, upper body cardio, upper body, lower body cardio. So I'll try to kind of keep some variety in there and never train the same muscles, you know, twice in a row, if that makes sense. In terms of the reps and sets, then my main focus is gonna be mostly strength-based movements. You know, I'm at my kind of desired body composition in terms of muscle mass. I don't want to build additional muscle mass. Like, I'm pretty above average with my muscle mass already, and I don't want to add, like, I don't need to add any extra muscle tissue. And I would much rather keep my body fat percentage low and focus on the strength-based movements, because the strength-based, you know, looking at the research, then strength is more important for longer longevity, whereas muscle tissue, you know, yes, it does go down with age, but if you train for strength, then you're going to have plenty of muscle tissue as well. So you should, you know, primarily focus on the strength, trying to get stronger, because strength is more of a reflection of health, whereas muscle tissue is more of a reflection of, you know, what you eat and how much protein you eat generally. Like, you can build muscle on any kind of diet as long as you're getting enough protein. Like, you could eat like just Twinkies and get a protein shake and still build plenty of muscle. And, you know, I mean, same applies to strength as well to a certain extent. But over the long term, you know, looking into decades into the future, then what matters more is going to be strength, in my opinion. And having more strength also means that you will have plenty of muscle tissue as well. So I like to focus on strength. So I'll train low on the lower rep ranges, mostly like 3 to 6 reps per set, and 3 to 6 sets per exercise as well. The exercise, I do like very little exercises. I do maybe three exercises per workout. So if it's a push workout, I'll do bench press and shoulder press, and maybe like some dumbbell flies on the side, or delt flies as they're called. On the pull workout, I'll do pull-ups or deadlifts and maybe forearm curls. That's it. Only three exercises. That's it. Takes me 30 to 45 minutes. I'm done. For the leg muscles, I'll do only squats and maybe, you know, Bulgarian split squats or something like that. And I'm pretty much done as well. So you don't need to spend hours at the gym. It's actually counterproductive, in my opinion. And focusing on strength is, I think, more important than just focusing on the muscle mass. What are the best glycine sources in vegetables? So plant-based foods generally don't have a lot of glycine. They don't have a lot of methionine either, which is good. So from the longevity side, then maintaining a balance between methionine and glycine is beneficial. So making sure that you don't get too much methionine and not enough glycine. If you eat only muscle meat, then you're going to get a lot of methionine and probably not enough glycine. So you want to balance that with some of the collagenous proteins like pork skin, chicken skin, drumsticks, bone broth, gelatin powder. Those things have the most amount of glycine and they don't have that much methionine. When it comes to plant-based foods, then yeah, the thing with plant-based food is that they don't have almost any methionine at all, and they have very little glycine as well. But the ratio is pretty good. Like, the ratio between methionine to glycine on plant-based foods is pretty good. So I do like to include, obviously, a lot of vegetables and different kinds of foods in my diet. Specifically, the highest glycine-rich foods that are vegetables are, you know, soybeans are actually probably one of the highest vegetable source of glycine. And the in Latin, soybeans mean glycine max. So that's kind of an interesting translation, that soybeans mean glycine max, but they're not really the highest source of glycine per se. Like pork skin or gelatin powder is the absolute highest amount of glycine from dietary sources. So, you know, soybeans, beans itself, legumes, they have, obviously they have a little bit more protein than broccoli, for example, but they have more glycine as well and less methionine. So these are the kind of the most plant-based foods that have the most glycine, but you shouldn't rely on getting that much glycine from just plant-based foods. It is true that your glycine demand on a plant-based diet is probably smaller than on a meat-based diet, because the plant-based foods also have very little methionine, so you need less glycine to balance the methionine, but you still need at least 12 grams of glycine for collagen turnover. So if you are eating only plant-based foods, then you're probably not getting those 12 grams. So you will want to add like either a gelatin powder in there, or, you know, eat some of the other, you make collagen peptide supplements as well, or just eat some of the other collagen-rich proteins like pork skin, chicken drumsticks, and those kind of things. Next question, what are the three best supplements everyone should take? I think number one is collagen peptides, because you start to lose your skin collagen content already in your 20s at a rate of 10% per decade. So it's like, if you start taking collagen in your 40s and 50s, then it's already too late in terms of that, because you have already lost at least 20% of your skin collagen content. So the earlier you start with collagen peptides, the better. And this is one of the supplements I think like everyone should take for the rest of their life. I don't see, at least in terms of the aesthetic side, because it helps with, there's like multiple human clinical trials showing that collagen peptides improve skin aging and slow down the hallmarks of skin aging. So it's a pretty well-researched supplement in that regard. And the second supplement I would probably add is, I would say like, you know, glycine, because, you know, you get some glycine from collagen peptides, but it's not nearly enough. You know, I personally take at least 5 to 6 grams of extra glycine on top of my already existing diet. And the specific brand of collagen peptides I take also has 5 extra grams of glycine per scoop. So I'm getting like 8 grams of glycine per scoop of my collagen protein. So I'm still like supplementing at least 10 grams of glycine per day from all the different sources, from supplemental and the collagen sources. So, but you know, yeah, the demand for glycine for optimal anti-aging, I think, yeah, is around 10 to 12 grams per day. You could get that from diet as well. Like if you eat a lot of gelatin powder, then yes, you can get it. Just drinking like a cup of bone broth isn't enough. Like you're not getting it's a research that you can't get adequate amounts of these collagen precursors from bone broth. You would need like either a higher pork skin diet or something like that, or to just supplement with collagen peptides or extra glycine. And the third supplement, you know, whether or not you need to take it depends on your age and depends on the other factors. I'll name two supplements here. They're going to share the spot for number three. They're going to be NAC and melatonin. Now, everyone doesn't need melatonin. Everyone doesn't need NAC, especially if they're younger than 40 years of age. It's been found that, you know, your glutathione levels decline rapidly after 45 and your body is able to resist oxidative stress before the age of 45. But after the age of 45, the glutathione levels rapidly decrease, and that's where you start to see also the age-related diseases, and you start to age much faster as well. So if you are over the age of 45, then I would certainly take NAC every day, like the GlyNAC and NAC combo, glycine and NAC. It also is very, you know, researched. It has many trials showing that it reverses hallmarks of human aging and improves functional outcomes such as muscle strength and gait speed and cognitive function. So, you know, someone in your 40s and 50s and 60s, I would take NAC at large doses as well, pretty much every day, like 5 grams even, because that's what's been shown to help with the hallmarks of aging. The same with melatonin. You don't technically need melatonin in your 20s or 30s, but in your 50s, you would certainly need to take like, I would certainly take at least like 1 milligram of melatonin per night, because your melatonin production decreases with age, similar to glutathione, and you make around 10 times less melatonin when you're 50 years old compared to when you're in your puberty. And, you know, melatonin is a very powerful antioxidant. It has many anti-inflammatory benefits. So something, if you are, you know, trying to age the most optimal way for longevity purposes, then yes, melatonin in your 50s is something I would, yeah, certainly take every night pretty much. But before that age, you know, I prefer to take like a smaller dose every now and then. I don't take it every night, but yeah, like just trying to boost your antioxidant defense with like 0.1, 0.3 milligrams melatonin before the age of 50 is also a good idea in my opinion. Next question. I know vaping is also harmful, but it's like 90 to 95% safer than traditional smoking, right? Better to avoid though. You know, yes, vaping might be slightly better than regular smoking, but at the same time, it's equally as bad. So, you know, you might not be like causing that much mechanical oxidative stress to your lungs as you would with a traditional smoke or a cigarette, but you are still causing chemical oxidative stress through the inhaling of these vapors that have obviously these different kind of chemicals in it. So they're both equally as bad in my opinion. Like, I don't know who came up with the idea that vaping is safer than smoking. Like, the research doesn't really back that up. It might reduce your risk slightly compared to traditional smoking, but remember what I just said before, even smoking a single cigarette per day puts you at 50% of the risk of heart disease as smoking 20 cigarettes a day. So let's say you do vaping, you know, most people don't vape just once a day, they might vape 5 to 6 times a day, then vaping 5 to 6 times a day is probably as bad as smoking one regular cigarette, probably a bit worse. So that already puts you at 50% of the increased risk of heart disease as smoking 20 cigarettes per day. So no, like, I don't think vaping is safer in the long term. It's in the short term, it is safer, but in the long term, it's equally as bad, in my opinion. And yeah, you know, don't vape. It's kind of very bad for you. It's kind of useless thing. It's certainly not healthier than regular smoking. And yeah, just try to avoid these kind of activities, whatever kind of smoke it is, like the hookah pipe that or the water pipe, that's very bad. Regular smoking of cigarettes, that's bad. You know, there's some ideas that smoking cigars, where you don't inhale the smoke, is somehow safer. I haven't found any research to back that up, but I would say that, you know, even smoking the cigars over the course of decades is still very bad for you. I don't think it's, you know, safe that it somehow prevents you from getting an increased risk of heart disease or cancer. Like, over the course of years and decades, you will still probably see the same increased risk, maybe a few percentages smaller, but like I said, even smoking a single cigarette per day puts you at 50% of the increased risk of 20 cigarettes per day. So just any amount of smoke, any amount of smoking activity from whatever source it is bad. And, you know, you should have like a zero tolerance policy, in my opinion. Next question, can you take creatine even if you're not working out? That's an interesting and good question. So creatine obviously is the most popular supplement for muscle strength and muscle building, but creatine has a lot of other health benefits as well and longevity benefits. Like, it improves brain, it reduces sleep demand, it supports methylation, and it's also been found to have like some anti-aging and longevity benefits in the elderly through maintaining muscle strength and muscle mass and also improving cognitive function. You know, yeah, taking a creatine supplement, even if you're not working out, is probably still worth it, and it will give you some benefits. If you are working out, then you will probably see, you know, more results from creatine supplementation, but that's also because you're working out. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you're working out or not, you would benefit from creatine, at least in some way. If you're not working out, then you would see probably a better result in terms of your, or you would notice more improvements in your sleep and cognitive function. But if you are working out and you take creatine, then you will obviously see also increased muscle strength and muscle power, maybe a little bit of muscle mass as well, or through the intramuscular water retention. So yeah, you will see benefits from creatine even if you are not working out, in my opinion. Maybe the dosage would be somewhat smaller if you aren't working out. So if you're working out, then you would, you know, the kind of good safe dose to take is like 3 grams, 5 grams if you're a heavier male. But if you're not working out, then maybe like 2 grams already is enough. So I don't think it's kind of good idea to take very large amounts of creatine, like 10 grams or something like that is kind of not needed. You might get gastrointestinal symptoms from very large amounts of creatine, and it might, you know, over the long term might impair your kidney function as well. But if you're taking only like 2, 3, 5 grams, then that's a safe amount. It's just that if you're not working out, then your demand for the creatine is also a bit smaller. So because creatine is used for ATP production, specifically the phosphocreatine system, which is the kind of maximum anaerobic performance. So if you're not engaged in a lot of explosive and strength-based activities like powerlifting or sprinting or stuff like that, then you don't, then you're not like burning through your creatine that much either. But you will still gain the benefit from the cognitive aspects of creatine. And the next question is similar to the smoking topic. So nicotine without tobacco, good or bad? So nicotine is an interesting substance. Obviously, you get nicotine from cigarettes, you get it from cigars. I guess, you know, some vapes also might have some nicotine in it. I'm not sure. I have never like actually vaped. But, you know, you can get nicotine from nicotine gums, nicotine patches, and these nicotine sprays as well. So nicotine, the I guess the biggest benefit to nicotine as a compound alone are its nootropic effects. So it can have some cognitive enhancement benefits, like it can improve your focus and attention span. I personally use the nicotine gum every once in a while. I think I use it maybe like once a week or something like that. And it's a pretty good like a compound for, yeah, like doing cognitive work. It can increase your like focus a little bit, put you into the zone quite nicely. If you combine nicotine gum with a little bit of coffee, then that's a pretty good nootropic. Like you can be in the zone for many hours by doing that. But nicotine in large amounts, it can also have some negative side effects, like it's actually vasoconstrictive, so it reduces blood flow. So chronic use of nicotine in large amounts probably is not a good idea in terms of cardiovascular disease. So from the brain health side, small microdoses of nicotine is good. It can improve like cognitive function. It might even have some neuroprotective effects because of that. But over the long term, in chronic use, I wouldn't say it's the best for cardiovascular disease. So I wouldn't use it like every day. I would use it like, you know, a few times a week and stick to like a dose of, you know, 1 to 2 milligrams at a time. If I'm not mistaken, then nicotine also has benefits for testosterone. It inhibits aromatase, which is the enzyme that converts testosterone into estrogen. So it could have like some testosterone boosting effects as well. And lowers the aromatase activity. So yes, nicotine is an interesting compound alone. You don't want to get the nicotine from cigarettes and smoking. Obviously, if you are interested in taking nicotine, then like the nicotine gums, 1 milligram, try it out. If you take it on an empty stomach, you might get nauseous and it can, you know, feel uncomfortable. But if you take it, you know, with food or something after food, then yeah, it can be a pretty good nootropic agent and helps you to like, you know, focus on the work. And the final question is, do you still do OMAD? I absolutely love it and picture myself doing it long term. Is it viable? I haven't been doing like a strict OMAD for the last, you know, 6 years. Like I said, I've always done my version of OMAD, which I call targeted intermittent fasting. I have a protein shake before my workout, then I work out, and in the evening around 5 p.m. or something, I'll have my dinner. So it's, you know, 1.5 meals a day. I consume most of the calories after the workout because I think that's where my body is most insulin sensitive and that's where my body uses the nutrients the most. And there is some benefits to working out semi-fasted by activating AMPK and working out in a glycogen depleted state. I think that you will gain like some super compensation effects as well in terms of the longevity pathways and metabolic health, obviously. But it's not very smart or it's hard to work out fasted all the time. So that's why I have the protein shake, which gives me around 30 grams of protein. And that is enough to make progress and build muscle and gain strength at the same time. And then I'll have the rest of my calories in the evening. I don't eat too many calories. I eat maybe 2,200, something like that, 2,200 calories per day. And that maintains a lean body composition year round for me while still having a high amount of muscle mass and a high amount of muscle strength as well. So I think for me, it works perfect to get the best of both worlds in terms of body composition and training and the longevity side. Now, is the regular OMAD viable for long-term? At least, you know, the way I do it, it's been viable for the last 6 or 7 years. So I haven't seen any, you know, problems with that. But a regular OMAD of eating strict 1 meal a day depends, yeah, like how much you train. If you don't have a particularly strenuous exercise routine and you're not super lean, then you can probably do it quite long. If you're overweight, then you can easily do OMAD. If you're not working out, then you can easily do OMAD. But if you start to be more advanced in your training, whether that be cardio training or strength training, then you will see, you will need something extra, in my opinion, at least in terms of maintaining muscle tissue and getting enough protein. Because yes, eating just 1 meal a day isn't optimal for protein synthesis and muscle growth and muscle building. But adding like a protein shake or just eating 2 meals in total instead of 1 meal can overcome that. So, you know, it depends a lot on your training status, your metabolic health, and your body fat percentage. The lower your body fat percentage, then it's better to get an additional meal. But the higher your body fat percentage, then you can easily do OMAD for a longer time, if that makes sense. All right, that's it for this video. If you want to ask me a question in the future, then make sure you follow me on Instagram at seemlun.com. But do you want to slow down aging and add healthy years to your life? Then I'm looking for more people who want to reverse their biological clock. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@seemlun.com and I'll send you the details. But other than that, thanks for watching this video. Make sure you click a like, subscribe, notification bell as well. My name is Seem. Stay optimized, stay empowered.